Hello and welcome to Talking Tudors, a fortnightly podcast about the ever-fascinating Tudor dynasty. My name is Natalie Gruniger and I'll be your host and guide on this journey through 16th century England. Are you ready to step through the veil of time into the dazzling and dangerous world of the Tudor court? Without further ado, it's time to talk Tudors.
Hello everyone, welcome back to another episode of Talking Tudors. I'm your host, Natalie Gruniger. Thank you so much for joining me today. I'd like to start by thanking the sponsor of today's episode, Sandra Bird, author of the Tudor Ladies in Waiting series. A rich alchemy of fact and fiction, these critically acclaimed books chronicle the glittering court lives of three queens and their closest friends and companions. The novels brim with heartwarming and heartbreaking circumstances and heroines who choose lives worth risking all. Book 1, To Die For, follows Queen Anne Boleyn through the viewpoint of Margaret Wyatt. Library Journal awarded it a Best Books of the Year pick and said the novel brings history to life in exquisite detail. Book 2, The Secret Keeper, uncovers love and betrayal in the life of Queen Catherine Parr. Library Journal calls this book atmospheric, full of twists and a must-read for Tudor fiction fans. Finally, Book 3, Roses Have Thorns, draws close to Queen Elizabeth I through Ellen von Snakenborg, who transformed into Helena, the Marchioness of Northampton. I loved all three books and found this concluding book masterful, impeccably researched, and deliciously detailed storytelling. The series is available at Amazon.com. As always, I'd also like to acknowledge and thank the generous listeners who continue to support Talking Tudors on Patreon and extend a heartfelt thank you to everyone who's taken the time to rate and review the show. As an independent podcaster, this really does mean a lot to me. If you love the podcast and you never miss an episode, I invite you to join the Talking Tudors Patreon community. Please visit patreon.com/talkingtudors for more information. When you join the Patreon community, you'll instantly unlock access to a plethora of exclusive posts. Patrons are eligible to attend additional monthly live talks and take part in a member-only book club. They can also enter patron-only monthly giveaways, to name but a few of the perks. You can also support the podcast and share your love of Tudor history with the world by buying Talking Tudors merchandise. Check out all the products at talkingtudors.threadless.com. Now, on to today's episode. I'm thrilled to welcome Dr. Nicola Clark back to the show to talk about her forthcoming book, The Waiting Game, The Untold Story of the Women Who Served the Tudor Queens. Dr. Clark is a senior lecturer in early modern history at the University of Chichester and writes about women in the Tudor period. Her first book, Gender, Family and Politics, The Howard Women, 1485 to 1558, was published by Oxford University Press in 2018. She also writes for public audiences with work featured in History Today and History Extra, and has appeared on television as part of the BBC's The Boleyns, A Scandalous Family, and More Fools Royal Scandals. Let's dive straight into our conversation. Welcome to Talking Tudors, Nicola. How are you?
Hi, thanks for having me. I'm very well, thank you.
It's lovely to have you back on the show. Before we dive into sort of the subject of our podcast, would you mind just introducing yourself to our listeners and just telling us a little bit about you and your background?
Sure. My name is Nicola Clark, but nobody calls me Nicola, and if they do, I don't know who they mean, which is confusing at conferences because I publish under Nicola because it sounds more formal and that is my name, but nobody uses it to me in real life. So there we are. I'm a senior lecturer in late medieval and early modern history down at the University of Chichester, and I also write freelance and record podcasts and do all sorts of other things as well. My first book was about the Howard women during Henry VIII's reign mostly. And my forthcoming book is called The Waiting Game, The Untold Story of the Women Who Served the Tudor Queens, which is about the ladies-in-waiting who served the six wives of Henry VIII.
Wonderful. And we are here to talk about your new book, which is very exciting. So Before we sort of dive in, do you want to tell us a little bit about what inspired this particular project?
Sure. Really, it was the last project that inspired this one in a nice blossoming kind of way. So in my last book about the Howard women, I wrote a chapter about them as courtiers because they're all over the royal court. They're in service, either in ordinary or in extraordinary, a lot of the time. So I thought, well, let's put them in context. And it was while trying to do that that I realized that the context I wanted to put them in just didn't really exist as a clearly defined piece of work. So I thought, well, all right, clearly there's the next project. So I started to work on that. And while doing that research, I kept coming across so many amazing stories. I just thought, I bet a lot of other people would be interested in this as well. So maybe I should write it for a broader audience.
Absolutely. Well, I agree with you. Do you want to tell us who the main women are that you actually feature? Because you do use some particular women as a lens in which to explore this subject.
I do. I picked a few key women who I could follow throughout as their careers overlapped and developed, etc., just because otherwise I think it would have been quite faceless. And I think you always need some human interest. So the first woman I start with really is Maria de Salinas, who became Lady Willoughby, and she's one of Catherine of Aragon's Spanish attendants. From her, I pick up with Elizabeth Stafford, who was Countess of Surrey and then became Duchess of Norfolk. She's an old friend of mine because she's a Howard girl by marriage. So she was the wife of Thomas Howard, who became Third Duke of Norfolk. So she was the aunt by marriage of Anne Boleyn, and she was the lady-in-waiting to Catherine of Aragon. I pick up with her daughter, Mary Howard, Duchess of Richmond, who married Henry VIII's illegitimate son, Henry Fitzroy, and was a lady-in-waiting to Anne Boleyn. I also use Gertrude Blount, Marchioness of Exeter. She wasn't in my original lineup, and I ended up including her because she, all of a sudden, in the early 1530s, was all over all my sources. And I thought, okay, well, I can't leave her out. Clearly, she's too important. She was a lady-in-waiting to Catherine of Aragon as well, and she was the wife of Henry VIII's first cousin, Henry Courtenay, Marquess of Exeter. I also used, again, who could not, Jane Parker, Viscountess Rochford, because she serves 5 out of 6 queens. She was the sister-in-law of Anne Boleyn, and she served Catherine of Aragon, Anne Boleyn, Jane Seymour, Anne of Cleves, and Catherine Howard. I've also used Anne Bassett, who maybe is slightly less well known, unless you're aware of the Lyell letters. She was the daughter of Honor, Lady Lyell, the stepdaughter of Arthur, Viscount Lyell. And she was a maid of honor to Jane Seymour, Anne of Cleves, Catherine Howard, and Catherine Parr. And then finally, I brought it around full circle with Catherine Willoughby, Duchess of Suffolk, who was the daughter of Maria de Salinas, my first woman. And she was a friend and lady-in-waiting of Catherine Parr.
Wonderful. What an excellent range of women. So, Nicola, if you're trying to become a lady-in-waiting, what do you need to do? How does one go about this?
Well, I think you need quite a lot of gumption, actually, because you can't just show up at court and hope the Queen happens to see you and likes you enough to take you in. What you need are the right connections. And the best connections to become a lady-in-waiting are existing ladies-in-waiting. Is that nepotism? I mean, yes, 100%, absolutely. Things worked in the Tudor court in the same way that they often do now. It's just that then they were honest about it. If you see what I mean, like, I think there are a lot of books that lean on the role of men in bringing women to court. So any biography of Anne Boleyn or Catherine Howard probably says that the Duke of Norfolk, their uncle, spoke to the king and it was arranged that way. There is some evidence that the king does have a role in accepting or declining women for the queen's household, but it doesn't seem to be a very formal process. It is the case when it's a brand new household being created for a brand new foreign queen. So Anne of Cleves, for instance, has her household put together for her by the king and by his ministers. But there is plenty of evidence to show that outside of that, female connections are the really key thing, even if the king maintains that power of veto. So when Lady Lyell wants to get one daughter or two daughters into the Queen's household, she's living in Calais and she relies on a London agent who's employed by the family to do business for her. Between them, they get one daughter, Catherine, the older daughter, into the household of the Countess of Sussex first, with the idea that the Countess will take Catherine to court so the Queen will see her and then she might be selected. That seems to have been quite a common way to do it. So you really need to kind of edge your way in. You've also got to keep your ear to the ground for any vacancies because they are like gold dust. So their London agent, John Hussey, writes lots of letters where he's like, oh, Mistress Parr's getting married. Oh no, that one's already been promised to someone else. Oh, but she might, oh no, she's going to keep her job after she's married. So he's continually on the lookout for where there might be a gap and where they might insert one of their daughters.
Okay, so if you've got the right connections, presumably you also need a skill set, something that the Queen's looking for. So what is it that you need to be able to do or have in order to be successful in this position?
Well, ideally, you need to be pretty. The Tudor idea of prettiness is incredibly kind of white and Western. You need pale skin, blonde hair preferred, blue eyes preferred. And that's not to say that people who don't have blonde hair and blue eyes are not at court. There are lots of them who are. But that's the kind of the ideal. So yes, you need to be pretty, but you need quite a diverse skill set beyond that. You need to be comfortable talking to a lot of different kinds of people appropriately. So saying the right thing to the right person in the right context, no matter what gender they are, what status, or even what nationality. So it could well be that language skills are also an advantage. These girls, they need to be able to dance. There's a lot of dancing. They need maybe to be able to sing or play musical instruments. They need to be able to ride so they can go hunting. And the thing that always gets me, they seem to need to be able to stay up late and then get up early over and over without flagging. I just think there's a lot of being on, you know, yes, and in public. Oh, and it exhausting. Must have been exhausting.
Absolutely. And can you tell us a little bit about the hierarchy that existed among the women attendants, you know, serving the Queen?
Yeah, so it is broadly related to social status. Court service for women, or for most people, came in two forms. So you might be in ordinary service, which meant you would be in lived-in daily attendance, or you could be in extraordinary service. It sounds weird, but it just means that you'd been drafted in to cover someone else's absence, or if you're a peeress, maybe you'd popped in to see the Queen while you were in town. In terms of numbers, the ordinary household is kind of the main one. There are probably only about 20 to 25 women in ordinary service at any given time. So I think if you're at court and you're a woman, you might well be quite conspicuous. It does get inflated for big occasions. So at Henry VIII's funeral in 1547, Catherine Parr has 45 women listed in ordinary service. My bet would be that that has been inflated, especially to put on a big show for the funeral. It's also true that each of those 20 or 25 women has her own female servants, but those are, even so, in a minority. And the ranks of women do seem to change a little bit, depending on who's making a list and what they decide to call them on that given day, which is frustrating for historians. So under Elizabeth of York, and at least under Henry's first few wives, so far as we can tell, you have maybe three basic ranks. So you've got ladies, who are the highest status. You've got gentlewomen, and they're the biggest group. And then you've got the chamberers, who are the slightly lower status, still gentry or kind of low aristocracy, but they tend to do the more menial tasks. As you move a bit later on, it does diversify a little bit. So under Catherine Howard, there's a list that shows maybe between two and four great ladies of higher status, seven or more ladies, or sometimes ladies and gentlewomen of the Privy Chamber, between two and four chamberers. And then you also got about six maids of honour, who were young adolescent women in their teens, for whom the royal court really functions as a kind of finishing school where they can polish their accomplishments, make connections, etc. And then there's also a pool of women in extraordinary who are on the bench, I guess, called in when the ordinary women have to leave for any reason, often if they've gone to have a baby.
Wonderful. And so you mentioned there that the chamberers are the ones sort of doing those menial tasks. What about the ladies and the gentlewomen? What are they for? What are their main duties?
That's something that I found really hard to pin down, and it's because they're not very clearly defined. Your duty does depend on your role, but if you're in ordinary in the Queen's household, you are basically on duty full time, 7 days a week. You're not meant to leave without permission. And really, what you're there to do is to serve the Queen in any way she requires. So that could be anything from helping her to get dressed and undressed, or bringing her or taking care of her clothes and her jewels. If you're a chamberer, you might be helping to keep her chambers clean. You are attending her wherever she goes, whatever she's doing, whether that's a banquet with a foreign ambassador. You might even share her bed at night. There's an anecdote from Catherine of Aragon's time. Once she's widowed when Prince Arthur has died, one of her Spanish women, Maria de Rojas, shares her bed at night because she's sad and lonely.
And so you talked a little bit earlier about, when we were talking about the skills needed, that of course they needed to be able to talk to people appropriately, people of different ranks. What were some other expectations in terms of their behaviour?
I think the biggest one is just behave yourself. When I was little, my dad used to kind of look over the rim of his glasses at me when I was being naughty and just say, behave, in a northern accent. And I sort of imagine it a bit like that. Evidence from the Lyell letters in the mid-1530s does show that this concept of the virtuous female courtier is taken quite seriously. So Lady Lyell is advised to make sure that her daughters hoping to enter the Queen's service were sober, sad, wise and discreet and lowly above all things, and to be obedient, to serve God and to be virtuous, for that is much regarded, to serve God well and to be sober of tongue, which just feels like a long-winded way of saying behave yourself.
Talking about the ladies in waiting that are there full time, as you mentioned, some of them were, how did they financially support themselves? Are these salaried positions that they have?
Again, that's a weird one because you would expect that it would be, but not necessarily. This could really vary. And that is the case with most court positions, to be honest. If they think you can afford it without paying you, they won't pay you. And again, for the historian, that's really frustrating because it means different names appear on different lists for different purposes. So during Henry VIII's reign, the lowest status of the Queen's women are the chamberers. They are paid. They usually have an annual salary of £6, 13 shillings and 14 pence, which is, it's all right, but it's not a lot by comparison with, for instance, the Queen's Lord Chamberlain, who gets £40 a year. The six teenage maids of honour have £10 a year, and these are usually paid quarterly. But otherwise, by Henry's reign, the Queen's women don't seem to have been routinely paid a salary. So they're supported by their husbands, by their families, or if they're widows, by themselves, by their jointure payments. But that does seem to mark a change from Elizabeth of York's reign. Her surviving privy purse account for the last year of her life shows that her women were paid wages according to rank. So it may just be that the pot of money out of which wages were paid is possibly what changes, and we maybe don't have the accounts for the relevant bit, because usually the Queen would be paying her women, and we don't have really any privy purse accounts for Henry's queens. We have bits from Anne of Cleves's household, and that does suggest she's paying her maids of honour and her chamberers, but nobody else. So whether that changes or whether they're simply being paid by another household office is not quite clear. But the Queen's women are taken care of in other ways, so they are all entitled to a certain amount of food and fuel and light and lodging, and sometimes there's some clothing that's provided as livery as well. So it board and lodging tends to be covered. You might not be salaried on top.
Okay, and I imagine that there are some other perks that these jobs may bring with them.
Absolutely, yes. And that's all about the gifts. It's a gifting economy. So the Queen's women often get gifts of clothing or even other valuable things directly from the Queen. So in May 1516, Agnes, Duchess of Norfolk, gets a gown of crimson velvet with Spanish sleeves lined with green cloth of gold of damask from Catherine of Aragon, and the Spanish sleeves really give that away. And the fact that it's a hand-me-down might be seen as a slight in our kind of current climate, but actually it's a huge honour to get the Queen's clothes. And the fabric itself is worth a huge amount. If Agnes now has that gown altered to fit her, wears it around the court with its Spanish sleeves, everyone's going to know that was a gift from the Queen. And it isn't just clothes. The Queen's women get gifts at New Year, which is when the court gives gifts. And usually if it's a gift from the King or from the Queen, it would be a piece of plate of a certain weight that is worth a certain amount depending on your rank. But the Queen's women do sometimes get more personal gifts from her. In 1522, there's a list of gifts given by Catherine of Aragon that includes a letter A of pearls set with diamonds that was given to the same Agnes, Duchess of Norfolk. And that's much more of a, you can imagine the Queen looking over her personal store of jewellery and picking that out deliberately for Agnes because it's the first letter of her name.
How wonderful. And did you find in your research that the women actually had some influence over what was going on with the Queen's business at all? Did they have any influence over her decision making, I suppose?
Well, that's really hard to tell unless there's some anecdotal evidence. Mm. I would say yes, most probably they did, but it's not the kind of thing anybody wrote down, except maybe occasionally by chance. Yeah. But there are sources that will often say, oh, this woman is of the most influence with the Queen or something like that, which shows that other people thought that they absolutely could influence the Queen and her decision making.
And what about some challenges that you found that people faced while attempting to serve the Tudor queens?
I think it's quite hard work. I think being at court in general, I think it could go from 0 to 60 really fast, like from boredom to sheer terror, just depending what's going on. It is usually said that women are at court to serve their families. Families want eyes and ears near the monarch, because then you know sooner what might happen. Women in service are well placed to see and hear all kinds of important information that they could then pass on. They also have access to some areas of the court that most or even all men just can't go into. So only the Queen's women will enter her bedchamber. So her women really function as almost like a barometer of the Queen's mood. So it's very, should we ask her now? No, try later. She's in a really bad mood right now. You really annoyed her. She really doesn't want to see you. Send someone else. And I think they might be her confidants, or they could be used by her to dispense patronage, etc. But they walk a really difficult line because they're supposed to be her confidants, her friends, but they're also there to be her chaperone. And so if you catch the Queen doing something the Queen isn't supposed to do, that puts you as a lady-in-waiting in a really difficult position. Because what do you do? Do you shop her to the King and his ministers? You're supposed to, because the oath of service that you take when you enter court service is to the King and to the Queen, and the King trumps the Queen. That only becomes a problem if the King and the Queen's interests diverge, but we see that so often during Henry VIII's reign that it must really have become a concern. It's, do you keep her secrets or do you not? That's a lot of responsibility. And it shows that being a courtier really creates this potential for conflicts of interest. You've taken an oath of loyalty to the Queen, but also to the King. But your family also expect you to fly their flag, do what's best for them, not just for the Queen. There's a really good example of this with Elizabeth Stafford, Duchess of Norfolk. She served Catherine of Aragon for 16 years altogether, and she got much closer to the Queen around the beginning of the royal divorce proceedings in the late 1520s and early 1530s. So there's a family link here. Elizabeth's husband, the Duke of Norfolk, is Anne Boleyn's uncle. So he and the rest of the Howard family are usually thought to have been supporting Anne and not Catherine, as you would expect. But Elizabeth now has a difficult choice to make. She's been in service with the Queen for a long time. She doesn't take the easy road. On the 27th of November 1530, Eustace Chapuis, the Spanish ambassador, reported to Emperor Charles V, his master, that a few days since, the Duchess of Norfolk sent the Queen a present of volaille, which is poultry, and an orange, enclosing a letter from Gregory Casali, which I send. The Queen thinks the Duchess did this out of regard for her, but I fear it was done with the knowledge of her husband as a means of entering into some secret communication with Her Majesty more easily. Gregory Casali, who wrote the letter, was the King's ambassador at the Vatican. And that suggests that Elizabeth is giving the Queen information about the progress of the case in Rome that she doesn't have access to any other way. So she's basically spying for her, which is not what her family would want her to do. And she keeps doing it. She sends the Queen lots of messages of support. She sends her reports of when Anne Boleyn quarrels with the King or with the Howards. And she's not the only woman who's supporting the Queen at this point, but most of the rest of them aren't defying the interests of their families. Most of them have husbands who are also known or suspected to be supporters of Catherine. And in a lot of cases, those men's hands were tied by their service to the King. But Elizabeth is acting alone, or at least more alone. She was eventually caught. She was too outspoken about it. She doesn't seem to have made enough effort to hide her loyalty. So in May 1531, she was sent home, apparently, according to Chapuis, because she spoke too freely and declared herself more than they liked for the Queen. So clearly, women's roles at court could be a bit more than just backing up family interests. She's actually doing things here. And it gets complicated when courtiers are forced to take sides in this way during Henry's reign. So I think being a lady-in-waiting quickly became much more difficult than it had been before.
Given the frequency with which Henry VIII changed wives, can you talk to us a little bit about the process of transitioning from one queen to the next? Is that an automatic thing? Do you need to reapply, in essence, or how does that work?
That is very idiosyncratic. So it's not automatic. It's always tricky. Each queen prioritised their family, their friends, but also some ladies with previous experience who can help her settle into her new role. Because for a lot of Henry's queens, they're not born to be queen. And several of them haven't even been around court all that long. So to then step into the role of queen is a big ask. So actually, you need people around you who know how this is supposed to work. And ladies-in-waiting is part of that. But it's not automatic. It's quite tricky, I think, to achieve who transitions and who doesn't. I think it often is somebody who could give the crown something as well as their experience. Or it might be somebody who is known to be indebted to the crown in some way and therefore will be loyal to the king. I do think Henry got more suspicious of his wife's ladies-in-waiting as time went on. And he tended to keep people he thought would be loyal to the crown. It didn't always pan out for him. I have a theory that Jane Parker, Viscountess Rochford, is one of these women. So she serves Catherine of Aragon. She moves to Anne Boleyn's household. I think that might be slightly more automatic because she's a relation. She's Anne's sister-in-law. So to cut her out would have been a really big snub. I think part of the reason she moves from there to Jane Seymour is because her evidence was used in Anne's trial. And while I don't think that Jane was, you know, deliberately seeking the death of her sister-in-law and her brother, I think that's a step too far. I think she may well have tried to do as she promised George, her husband, she'd do and go and sue to the king for him. But I think at that point, the king is not seeing anyone. So I think she ends up in front of Thomas Cromwell. And I think being in front of Thomas Cromwell, when Thomas Cromwell would like to know something, it's very difficult. And I think that it would be very easy to judge her and say she spilled all sorts of private conversations that were then used against the queen and against her husband. And yes, that's what happened. But I don't think we should judge her for that. I think we shouldn't underestimate how frightening it is to be suddenly questioned by Thomas Cromwell. But possibly because of that, she sort of, in a perverse way, gains his protection. She writes to him and to the king after George's death and after she's widowed, saying, "I'm a poor widow, help me out here." And they kind of do. They force her father-in-law, Thomas Boleyn, to give her more money. He's really unwilling to do that. But they also give her a place in Jane Seymour's household. And while you can't prove that those things are connected, my hunch is that that's why, because they know she gave them evidence. Therefore, now they will look after her. Of course, that backfires later on when she helps Catherine Howard to see Thomas Culpeper, but nevertheless. So I think transitions could happen for a variety of different reasons. And sometimes it is experience. Sometimes it's because the crown trusts a particular woman. Sometimes it's for show. I mean, you do need a certain number of women of a certain kind of status to serve the queen. And sometimes it's just because you lobbied really, really, really hard at a time when a new household is being created. So when Anne of Cleves' household is created, I think there is a lot of back and forth. I think Cromwell's inbox must have been very flooded with people making requests for daughters and sisters and whatnot at that time.
And you were talking earlier about sometimes women leaving service in order to have children and that kind of thing. In terms of retiring, if you wanted to leave service completely, was that an option or did you kind of have to wait to be kicked out or for a new queen to come along?
No, you don't have to be kicked out or wait for a new queen. You absolutely could retire. It could be that once you're in, it's a job for life. But it usually, for most women, I'd say it isn't. Most of them do retire at some point. There's a weird enduring urban myth that ladies-in-waiting left as soon as they got married. That while some did, that's not the case at all, actually. Some of them stayed even after their marriage. So Maria de Salinas, Catherine's Spanish lady, is one of really only a couple that I found who stay in England and stay in her service after 1509. Maria marries in 1516. She marries an English nobleman, William Willoughby. His estates are mostly in Lincolnshire. And sometimes that's a reason why ladies-in-waiting left. If their new husband's lands are quite far away, then it becomes harder to split your duties, I suppose, as estate manager and wife and mother with your job at court. But it really seems to have depended. Maria is one of the Queen's favourites. William Willoughby doesn't seem to have been much of a courtier, but he doesn't seem to have minded his wife carrying on. So she stays after her marriage. But there are other women, especially younger maids of honour, who will leave court when they marry, possibly because marriage was the goal of being at court in the first place. But no, you can retire, or sometimes women were retired against their will, but that's particularly the case for Catherine of Aragon's women. So in the early 1530s, when Catherine is banished from court and sent away first to the moor and then to all of those damp fenland castles, Henry won't let her favourite women go away with her. So the women Catherine ends up with are generally lower status. Several of them have been with her for a really long time, but women like Maria, who are known to be very partisan towards Catherine, are not allowed to continue in her service. So they are forcibly pensioned off. It does seem to be the case as well that a princess's women or a queen's women will leave in groups at certain set points along a life cycle, along the queen's life cycle. So a number of Catherine of Aragon's Spanish household leave in 1509 when she marries Henry VIII, because that's an obvious break point. Sometimes they're sent away. So Princess Mary Tudor, Henry VIII's younger sister, when she marries Louis XII of France in 1514, she takes English ladies with her and they're supposed to stay on with her. That would be usual, at least for a certain amount of time. But Louis XII dismisses them the morning after the wedding. She's distraught about this and the English are horrified because it had all been arranged. So it is a bit subject to the whims of royal men. And it really just depends what is going on during your time of service as to when you might retire.
Thank you. And I have one more question for you, and that is our Tudor takeaway. So I do ask all my guests for something for our listeners to go off and explore after the episode. So do you have a takeaway for us?
I do. So one of my favourite books about the Tudor period in recent years has been The House of Dudley by Joanne Paul. So if you haven't already read that, go and do it. It is family saga on an epic level. It follows three generations of Dudley men and women. Each generation, somebody is named as a traitor and a tainted. It's like they just couldn't get away from that. It's an incredible read. So that's my takeaway.
What a wonderful takeaway. Thank you so much. And thank you so much for making the time to come back and talk Tudors with us.
Thanks for having me. It's always fun.
Well, that brings us to the end of this episode of Talking Tudors. Thank you so much for joining us. I absolutely love to hear from listeners, so if you have any comments or suggestions, or just want to say hi, please get in touch with me via my website, www.onthetudortrail.com, where you'll also find show notes for today's episode. If you've enjoyed the show, please share the podcast with friends and family, and don't forget to subscribe, rate, and review. I also invite you to join our Talking Tudors podcast group on Facebook, where you can interact with other Tudor history lovers and hear all the behind-the-scenes news. You'll also find me on Twitter. My handle is On The Tudor Trail, and on Instagram as The Most Happy 78. It's time now for us to re-enter the modern world. As always, I look forward to talking Tudors with you again very soon.